the baby was 3 months and I was happy. I went to the doctor and the surgery didn't quite happen the way that it was supposed to be. And one thing that it taught me was that life can change in a minute, so you should just take advantage of it.
Welcome to the Baker Lab Podcast. I'm Ian Hayden with the University of Washington.
And I'm David Baker, the director of the Institute for Protein Design. In this episode, we'll hear from Parisa Hossein-Zadeh, a really remarkable scientist who's done both wonderful science and has a really amazing life story to share with you. She's very determined, very smart, ambitious on the one hand, and on the other, she really cares about people. When she was in the lab here, she would frequently come to talk to me to tell me people I should be looking out for and who I should try to be helping. And she also often told me how I could be doing my job better, which I was very grateful for.
That was welcome advice.
It was all advice I get is welcome advice. Yes.
I'm Parisa Hossein-Zadeh. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Oregon, and I've been here for 4 years. Yeah.
So, Parisa, could you tell me about where you're from and what kind of student you were?
I am from Iran, in Tehran, the central city of Iran, up until 11. And then we went back to Nishapur, which is a really small city. And I was there until I actually took my undergrad exam. Yeah. I think I was one of those kids that her fun was reading books, geography to mathematics.
Could you tell me a little bit about your parents?
My parents are both teachers. One of them was working at a tech company before he came back to teach. My father has 2 undergrad degrees, and my mom went ahead and got her PhD the same time that I got my PhD. So,
oh wow,
yeah.
It sounds like you were interested in a lot of things when you were a kid. Did that have anything to do with both of your parents being teachers?
I'm not sure, because although they were teachers, one of them was literature and one of them was arts and running. So this much excitement about science wasn't something that I would say was granted to me. But the fact that I liked all of those things was definitely coming from the fact that both of my parents were teaching some studies of different fields, and reading and studying was always a part of me, I guess.
Got you. So I'm curious then, what got you interested in science?
I don't know. I really, really liked scientific books in general from the beginning. But I think the fact that you have a question and then you have to resolve it, and there were all these amazing people that all their life was to ask questions and try to resolve them, was just interesting to me. Yeah.
How did you end up in biotechnology?
So in Iran, we have a general exam. We don't have like separate exams for different universities. All the universities use just one exam. My grade was really, really good at that. And I wanted to go study physics, but there's physics, which you go and study and get undergrad. And there's this special physics that you go directly to graduate school. And I was going to study that, but that year, physics didn't get it. And I was like, whatever, just you choose for me. And all of my family members decided that I have to go and study biotechnology. And I was like, sure, I'll study biotechnology. But I'm happy that I went ahead and studied that because, oh my God, it had everything that I liked, and I just didn't know that it existed.
Wow, so you were aiming for physics and you really just you told your family, "Hey, you pick for me." Wow. So it sounds based on that story that you aren't the kind of person who, even when you were a little kid, you knew exactly what you wanted to do with your career or what kind of person you wanted to become. It sounds like you figured that out as a student and as a young person.
Or at least I felt like I figured that out. And then the entity of the thing I was gonna study changed. And also the fact that I came to America. But overall, yeah, I would say that from the beginning, it was sure that I'm gonna be someone who will get a PhD.
I see. So, did you do your undergraduate studies at home in Iran and then you came to the US for graduate school?
Yes, I did get my undergrad studies at Iran. And undergrad studies was really interesting because, first of all, it was the first time that I was with a group of people that had boys in them too. In Iran, boys and girls are separate until they get to undergrad. So before then, I was not used to seeing boys around. And it actually, I think it helped me build my strength because if I saw a lot of boys that had a lot of confidence in themselves, it was possible that I didn't do that well. Then I went to undergrad and suddenly there were also boys around me. And it was, I think it was necessary, but it was also, it had hassles too. It was, I would say, overall, it was a very good experience. And I was with a lot of great people that are still with me. So I should thank them for giving the opportunity that to me that I wasn't really afraid of. But overall, just like coming from a small place to a big one and having a lot of changes will have an effect on you anyways.
Wow. So I guess let's jump to when you left Iran and you were looking at graduate school. I understand you applied to a lot of different places. Can you talk about that?
So, why did I apply to a lot of places? I applied to Australia because my aunt was living in there at that time. And then I applied to one place in Canada just because, I don't know, it was there, so I said, why not? And then I applied to one place in Germany because a lot of my other friends were applying to, so I was going to see what's happened, what will happen. And it was like a safe bet. And then I applied to, I think, seven or eight schools in the United States. But some of them, I knew that I wouldn't get them, but I applied to them anyways.
Did you consider staying in Iran, or were you only applying to universities outside of Iran?
So a year before I applied, there was an Iranian election for the prime minister.
Hmm.
And the person who we thought is going to win lost. And it was really not Okay. I don't know what happened, but everyone said, oh, they're changing the results. And then a lot of fights happened after that. Lots of our friends were gotten. Yeah, this is just like so hard for me to say. But the Iranian situation was bad because of the whole turmoil. And even like one of our faculties died. So we were like, I said that I'm not gonna stay after this point because I can't really work in here. And that's why I applied next year. Could I stay there for another year? Perhaps, perhaps. But I feel like this was the path that I take was the path that I wanted to, just because I was so afraid of Iran in general.
I see. I see. So you ended up going to graduate school in the US. That must have been a very big change. Can you tell me about that?
That was a very big change. Yes. I remember that I was talking to my friends, and they said that it's better to not wear any hijab in America because no one cares about it. And if you really don't think it's something that you should hold on, it's better to not have it from the beginning. And I felt like they're right. But we had a big, big fight with my mom. Yeah, it was really bad. And also, other than that, I feel like the flight, we just cried and cried and cried and cried. By reading like the memories that people wrote for us, and then when we got there, the first semester was also kind of sad, and I hadn't still overcome the sadness that I had for my parents and my sister. It got better and better, I should say, a lot better, but the first 3 months was really, really hard. And that's also the time that we had to choose our lab. So it would make the lab choice much harder.
What were you studying in graduate school?
I studied biochemistry, but my lab was actually in the chemistry and was affiliated in biochemistry. So I was basically in chemistry department, which was better. And I was studying rational design of metalloproteins in general.
I see. So you were quite the biochemist already. Were you working in that area before coming to the US, or did you first get into that in graduate school?
Working in Iran is really interesting. So I did a little bit of biochemistry when I was in Iran, but because of the sanction and the problems that Iran has, almost all of our materials, the ones that we needed to do experiments, they're getting like delayed or sustained. So, like the thing that would take 2 days, 3 days in a lab would take a year in our lab because we didn't have most of those materials. So I had worked a little bit on that. I knew like how to hold a pipette. I knew a lot of smaller things. But then I learned that one of the things that took me 6 months to be done happened in a week. So, yeah, most of it I would say I learned when I was coming to the US.
I see. Your time after graduate school as a postdoc, you were part of the Baker Lab. And actually, that's where I first met you. I worked alongside you for a couple of years. I would love to hear a bit about at the end of your time in the Baker Lab, you decided you wanted to become a professor yourself, become a faculty member. Can you talk about what motivated you to pursue that?
Good question. So almost all the people come to the Baker Lab to become a PI or start a company. So if you don't choose that, then you're different. I don't feel like I had a strong opinion and then David changed it, but David made me more confident in applying and knowing that my material is good enough for any university that I send the material to that. So I think that's what David Baker did to help me a lot.
I think that's an important part of my job. Important part of being a mentor is to give people confidence to be able to go out and be successful. And people often undervalue themselves. And so my job isn't really all that hard. I just have to get people to see themselves as they are and not as who they think they are. It's a little bit of a scary thing to be applying for a faculty position and be first evaluated and then actually having to do it to run your own show. But I was absolutely convinced that she could do it and do it very well. And I told her that many times.
I'd be curious if you could share what that faculty hunt was like for you. I understand it's not an easy thing to go through.
No. I think faculty hunt is like one of the biggest problems that everyone faces. It starts from like June of the previous year. You need to write everything, you need to prepare everything, you need to give it to at least three people to have a look at them, read them, probably change their writings multiple times. Then at the end of September, you can get results to come and talk for us. And that is in and of itself a big hassle because first of all, if you're not good, you're feeling sad. If you're good, you have to go to a lot of universities. You feel bad on the other way because you get tired when you get to like February, I would say. So it's really a stressful process. And then one or two faculties from the universities that you taught would give you a call, and then you should go and you should talk to them. This time it's about you, but still it's like really annoying. And then you have to make the decision, which is also difficult. So it's a year of torture, I would say,
Wow.
for you. But then at the end, hopefully the end result is good. Although, yeah, a lot of US universities doesn't care too much about your spouse, which makes it harder.
I think we'll come back to that. Let me ask about your research today. How would you explain what your lab does, what your current research is about, to somebody who doesn't do science as their job?
That's hard. That's hard. If I want to just explain very broadly what I do, I'll tell them, hey, do you know proteins and that they're in our bodies and do a lot of important things? We are going to design novel proteins and peptides that does a huge repertoire of everything that we may need.
you mentioned peptides in there, and I know from your time as a postdoc in the Baker Lab, you focused a lot on peptides. What is a peptide, Parisa?
Peptide is a really teeny tiny protein.
Let me ask you on the personal side, how did you get interested in peptides as a research topic?
Ha 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 ha. Okay, this is also another interesting one. So, Amir and I talked and we decided that we're going to go and do the postdoc in the Baker Lab. And when I was there, I wanted to choose a project that is simple enough and had less hands in it that I can quickly publish and go out and be next to my husband. And then I talked to a lot of things and all the topics were really interesting. But I noticed that the peptide group is the one that only had two people at that time. And they needed a hand. So I was like, oh, I'll come and help you. And the code that Vikram wrote, he couldn't make it to work experimentally because I think he just didn't have the time and a little bit of patience. And he wanted to do 20 other things. So I got it from him and ta-da, the science paper. So actually that was the reason that I chose peptides, but I really love peptides, so.
That's fascinating. And now are peptides the focus of your lab?
One focus of my lab. The other focus, which is mostly for undergrads, is designing binders against different proteins. And then another big group is actually designing enzymes and metalloproteins.
I see. So a wide range of design projects.
Yeah. The one that uses design of metalloprotein is basically coming from the fact that I was at the ELU's lab, and then I get all this training on de novo protein design. So I was like, let's combine them. And also I have a great postdoc that actually handles all of that. So
there you are. You were a pretty new PI in Oregon, running your own lab. And I understand that you had quite a difficult experience having to do with your health. And I'll say for our listeners that, Parisa, you wrote an account of this health event that happened to you in your recovery, and you wrote it and published it in Nature.
Yes.
And I think it's a really fascinating personal account, not just of this health episode that you went through, but what it's meant for you as a scientist and as a academic researcher and the impact that it's having on your career.
Apparently in my brain there is a mishmash of vessels that don't do anything, and I didn't know that, because why would I? And when I got pregnant in the last months, actually I got a little sensitive and they took me to the hospital in Portland. And then in Portland, they just opened a quick hole in my head and it disappeared after 2 weeks. Yeah. But I don't know the details because the first 2 weeks are hazy. But I got better. Nothing had happened to me and everyone was like, wow, this is miracle. The baby was born healthy, and then I decided to just have surgery and take it out because it was supposed to happen again and that time it would be faster. So after reading a bunch of different doctors, we chose one that was in Stanford, and we went there. The baby was 3 months and I was happy. I went to the doctor and the surgery didn't quite happen the way that it was supposed to be. And at the end, the doctor actually had to cut one of the bigger vessels on the left side, actually. And for 4 or 5 days, I was in the hospital. I mean, they tried to walk me and stuff. And the doctor was like, try to move. And I remember that I couldn't even talk. And I know that it must have been not only a bad events for me, but also bad events, and like that something that makes somebody sad for a lot of people around me.
And at this time, this was the third year of you being an assistant professor. Is that right?
It was going to be, yeah.
I see. So you were quite new to this role still. And my understanding, when you're starting a new lab and you're trying to get to tenure, that's a very stressful time in a person's career. There's a lot of demands of the job at that point. And it sounds like on top of that stress of work, you're not only pregnant, but you're dealing with this very serious health event, this neurological event.
Yeah, the first 3 months was not fun, but there was one good thing about it, and that was the fact that we didn't have to work because we had 3 months off for having the baby.
I see. So yeah. You were able to focus on your health during that time.
Exactly. I mean, I wrote a few papers, but in total, I was mostly focused on finding a doctor.
Right. And just so I understand, so while you were pregnant, you had an initial neurological event that that put you in the hospital for a number of weeks. But actually, in following that, after your baby was born, you underwent some additional surgeries, and it was during those events that you suffered one or more strokes as well.
Yes, that's exactly what happened.
Wow. And I know that recovery from all of this has been a major part of your life. I'm curious, what has recovery looked like for you?
Recovery looks like a very slow, steep road ahead. Whatever I do, I always remember the person I was. And first, I feel like, yeah, I can do this. I should be better. But also, I feel like sometimes I feel like, why should I go to this much trouble? I mean, my neurological doctor think that since this was there from very early on, it formed a lot of connections without needing to eat from the vessel that was deformed. And I'm very lucky. But yeah, it's just like, it's very hard. But I'll keep running it because I went down so bad that every step that I take is an improvement, right? So.
Absolutely. When I first read your account of this that you published online, it's heartbreaking. So yeah. I understand if this is difficult to talk about, I completely understand, but I appreciate you sharing this experience. So at one point when you had suffered this event related to the surgery and these strokes, when your condition, you said, was extremely poor.
Yes.
You had limited movement. And you were having a lot of difficulty communicating.
Yes.
I understand that you were using a wheelchair to get around.
Yes.
Which you hadn't needed before.
Yes.
And you write that a short time later, it probably didn't feel very short, you ran a 5-kilometer race.
Yeah.
So
last year.
This rehabilitation, this journey you've been on and that you're still on is, honestly, it's incredible.
Thank you.
I don't remember how I first heard about Priest's incident, but I remember being really super sad and horrified about how serious it seemed. And then when I first interacted with her afterwards, it was clear that she had a long path backwards, but it's been really gratifying over the time since. Every time I've interacted with her, she's made huge strides back and she's now fully recovered. But during that recovery period, I was really impressed at the progress she was making and at her determination to make it back. And I think that really ties into her overall determination, love of life that I talked about earlier.
How did you do that, Parisa? I mean, that's incredible. How did you find the strength to keep going like that?
It wasn't always easy. And it would have been impossible if Amir and my other families wasn't there, but especially Amir. But also I feel like I have the tendency of not believing that I cannot. So that also was it. And also some of the features that I had helped me too. For example, I didn't have any pain. A lot of the people that come and had a stroke actually have pain, and that's not good. Sometimes very bad. So I didn't have that. And also I went to sleep really easily. I went to sleep early. I did all the things that a successful person would do. So I mean, it was partly luck, but partly Amir and my family. And then I would say partly myself too, yeah. And I would say, I mean, one thing that it taught me was that life can change in a minute. So you should just take advantage of it. And also that a lot of things that I thought would matter, on the grand scheme doesn't matter. As long as you manage to be good, you're gonna be fine. And another thing that I learned was that if you don't exercise enough, you're gonna regret it. This happened to me once, so. Yeah. I mean, I'm here. I'm a lot better. I still have to do a lot, but I know what people have gone through. And also, I know a lot of people come talk to me, and a lot of them know someone that actually had a stroke. Yeah, this is also one of the reasons that I was gonna talk to people around me. A stroke can happen to everyone. And surprisingly, it continues to get better. I'm at the beginning of year two now, and I think I've improved a lot more.
I couldn't agree more with what Parisa just said. I think you want to live your life so you take advantage of every moment and you don't want to sweat the little things. That's very important to me in my job. I have to keep focused on the things I think are important and not worry about the rest.
Wow. This is such an incredible story, Parisa, and I'm so glad that you're willing to talk to me about it. I've heard you use a word to describe yourself. I've heard you say that you're stubborn.
Yes, yes.
Can you tell me about that?
I'm stubborn in that I don't want to give up. I never give up. And new situation just drives me to go more and get that done also. So I feel like in that regards, it has been good for me.
I think that's extremely clear to see in this story about your health and about your
Yeah.
rehabilitation. Has that played out in your life as a scientist as well?
I think so. I think so. Being stubborn is not always good, I should say. There were some projects in especially PhD lab that I insisted on doing, although it didn't work, just because I didn't read the papers enough to know that it doesn't work. So being stubborn alone is not enough, but I feel like it's a driving force that's very strong to take you to the next step, you know, and show you that, oh, this can be done, this can be done. I'm sure this can be done. I spent lots of time in the lab after the lab was done just to finish this or just to get one last EPR, one last electrochemistry, one last peptide to synthesize, you know.
Parisa is a very determined person, very talented and very imaginative, and her stubbornness and determination have enabled her to do great science and to overcome obstacles of all sorts of kinds.
I'm curious, can you tell me what does a normal day look like for you now when you're working and maybe start in the morning?
Oh, well, starting in the morning, our waking up depends on when Mana gets up, our daughter, which is not the best thing, but it's okay. And then we usually go have breakfast with her. And then if I wake up really early and Amir is there or mom's around, I'll get to do some exercise. If not, I'll take care of the baby. And then we take him to nanny, and then after that, my life starts. Until then, this is mostly Mana's life. And then I usually meet with my people, and then write grants if I have to write grants. If not, I'll read some papers. I'll do some other important things that have been postponed. Postpone to the later. Sometimes I have time to do some exercise in the lab. And then just like this, lab is done. It's 4:30, 4:45. We have to go and get our kid. And then it's like cooking, giving food, forcing the baby to sleep. And if we have time, if we have time, a little more work, or if I haven't done my exercise. So it's a boring life, but at least it's good for me because I have control over it, which is good. Right now I need control, and I feel like it's gonna be different maybe 5 years from now, but right now this is what I have, and overall, it's almost always the same.
Well, that doesn't sound boring to me. It sounds busy.
Yes, busy and boring.
Let me ask, what's your favorite thing about the work that you're doing now?
Talking to people. I love talking to people. I actually liked writing grants also, but after this show that's happening, I'm not sure how I feel about writing grants now. I like sitting down and thinking about new projects. Yeah. And I like doing some services. I feel like I'm in a job that suits me. It has a little more than what I may need sometimes. But overall, I like it.
You mentioned writing grants. Writing is a big part of what being a professional scientist does, and I heard you share a detail as part of your recovery from your stroke that actually you've been using a ChatGPT, you've been
Yes.
using language models in ways that you found helpful, both as someone recovering from a stroke and as someone who needs to write for their job as a scientist. Can you share a bit about that?
So the first time that I used ChatGPT, it was because I wasn't good enough at communicating at all. And I feel like ChatGPT helped me write the things that I wanted, but I couldn't say. And it was, I think, a gift in that sense, because if I had the stroke 5 years before, I don't think that that thing existed, right? I don't think ChatGPT existed. And then as I got better in writing, then I used ChatGPT for different things, right? Now I use it to write letters for me, for example, by giving some of the important notes about a student, or like I ask them to fine-tune my writing, you know? So the use has changed, but it's still there. And I think it's a really important thing in my life, and I think in many people's life.
Yeah, I think ChatGPT and large language models for text generally are a real equalizer. Almost all science is conducted in English. And so if English is your native language, you sort of have an advantage over non-native speakers. Or maybe a better way to put it is that if you're not a native speaker, you have a bit of a disadvantage in, say, in communicating, particularly in writing. And what I've found in the last year is that this disadvantage has gone away because if you're not a native speaker, but you've learned how to use these tools, you can totally make up for any kind of disadvantage you have, and to the point where one really can't tell whether someone's a native speaker or not. So I think it's really a great equalizer. And I think, sort of optimistically, as more and more AI technology comes online, that it helps people make up for things that might be putting them at a disadvantage. And as Parisa says, in communicating after a stroke, that's a great example.
So I'm going to switch gears a little bit now, Parisa, and ask you a series of a little less chronological questions. But is that okay?
Yes, of course.
What's something you like about being a scientist?
Oh, I would say trying to solve a problem with the tools that you have or tools that you don't have and you have to make.
And is being in science just like how you thought it would be, or is it pretty different?
It's like just as I thought I would be. I think it's because in Iran, at least, we give a lot of our scientific interest from the movies that show scientists to us. And yeah, that's why I know a lot of people in Europe, in America, in Canada that are very good in science. And I was like, yeah, if they can be, I can be so.
Wow, that's fascinating. In your opinion, what makes someone a good scientist?
Oh, what makes someone a good scientist? She's curious and she searches for the problems. And she knows that sometimes the problems may not be anything that was written on the sheet for her. And she may change her way of thinking at things and trying to solve it from another way. And I think a lot of people miss one or two of these, and we all miss part of it, and we all go to undergrad and masters and postdocs to gain these skills. But I think these are the three things that are important.
Has your view of what a good scientist looks like changed over time?
Yes. It involves more women and that wasn't the case before. It involves more people of color. It involves a lot more people that has some sort of disability, just because I had to go through it and I know how difficult can it be. And I really I'm interested in showing also the rest of community that we can also be scientists and have some disabilities as well, right? When I was little, I always thought that the scientists that get the Nobel Prize is because they're working on this massive, big problem that everyone's wondering about. But now I know that all scientists work on very tiny, tiny little points. And sometimes the tiny points that X is working is better than Y. And that's why he or she gets the Nobel Prize. But it doesn't mean that jobs of other people are also not important.
I think that's well said. Is there anything that you would like to change about how science is done?
In academia, they want scientists to be a writer, tries to write grants, gives lessons. Do science, take care of the lab, be part of the community. This is not possible. And I think everyone knows that. And I think someone at some point should do something about it. Like, I mean, I love teaching, for example, but if I teach one semester, and that semester, I can't do anything else, you know, or very little. Or if I'm writing a grant that's very important, I can't really take care of the students that much. If I want to take care of the students, I don't have time to do anything, you know? So maybe it's because I'm still young. Or maybe it's because I'm in the next generation that we are all part of. Work are just harder. And it's good to think about ways that can divide this work. And I should say, by the way, that our department is excellent. Okay? They do most of the work that you don't need or you don't have to for you. So that's good. And although they're so good, still I sometimes feel like, oh, I wish someone would write this part for me. So now you can imagine what would happen to the people that don't even have such a good staff system in hand. So.
I gotcha. Yeah. I'm curious, what are some directions that you're excited to pursue next?
I am really excited to run some sort of deep learning in permeability. We tried to run it once and I got distracted with stroke and couldn't solve it, but I think we can solve it. And then I would be really excited if we have de novo copper-containing proteins. It would be really cool. And then Kevin is making new, completely novel organometallic enzyme that it would be cool to see. So two things that I'm really excited about.
That's great. All right, I've got one last question maybe that we can end on. But before we get to that one, I think just in case our listeners hear this episode and they're at all concerned, we mentioned that when your health episode first started, you were pregnant and you gave birth shortly after. How is your daughter?
She's wonderful. She's good. And she's in terrible too.
Terrible twos. All right. Well, good luck with
Yeah,
that.
it's okay.
I wanted to ask, is there someone who really helped you become who you are today? And if so,
Oof.
can you tell me about them?
A lot of people. A lot of people. It's just like really hard to say. My parents, my husband, my sister, my uncle, my advisors. There are a lot. Almost everyone in my life has effects in me some way or the other. So it's hard to select just few of them.
I think your story shows not just what a remarkable person and remarkable scientist you are, but what that kind of support and what that kind of community can do.
Exactly.
Well, thank you, Parisa, so much for talking to me
Of
today.
course. Thank you too for talking to me and listening to all the words that I had for people.
Thanks for listening to the Baker Lab podcast. Your host this episode was Ian Hayden. This episode was recorded at the Institute for Protein Design at the University of Washington School of Medicine. It was produced by Nora McNamara Bordwick, Preeti Biswas, Ian Hayden, and Roni Weissman, with help from Anisha Segal, Joe Min, and Nathan Greenwood. Our music is by Kevin MacLeod. Please subscribe and leave a rating if you like this show, and we'll see you next time.